We're on our last class of Easy Habits for a Happy Life, Easy Habits for Happiness. Been both a long and a short course. So the course has been based on Buddhist psychology. So it's, you know, relevant whether you're religious or not. We all have psychology, don't we? We all have the system of how our heart and our mind works. So the Buddha's insight into that has been pretty extraordinary. And explaining not just our own inner workings and all of the kind of chain reactions that we have as human beings, but showing that there is a way to completely remove all of those disturbances from our mind, and there is a way to attain authentic happiness or lasting happiness. It's not just some idealistic dream, but if we really understand our nature and how we work as human beings, there is something that we can do about it that is quite vast and profound. So human emotion, it's a universal thing. It doesn't depend on theories or even cultures. How it's expressed, of course, depends on cultures, but those inner workings, that's universal. And actually, not just for humans, but we can see on a much more simplified level these same processes happening within animals. If you live with pets, you'll know what I mean. So I might just get up the screen share and we can just see what we've already covered so far. So we've had our, we've been going through the 10-point checklist, what to practice and what not to practice. And so that is based on the checklist of avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions. And instead of just leaving a vacuum, what to practice in their stead. So the 10 non-virtuous actions, the word virtue can sometimes feel a bit uncomfortable to people. In the Buddhist kind of mechanics, I suppose, what virtue is whatever brings long-term happiness. So we want to act virtuously for ourselves and for others because we all want long-term happiness. So it's not so much to do with whether someone's decided this is good or bad, but it's just looking at what are the long-term results of how we interact with ourselves and with the world. And I've found it incredibly useful to have this checklist because I haven't necessarily known what to do in my life. It's really good to have some pointers. So the checklist is often described as being like road signs. So as we're going through our twisty, twervy road through life around some pretty hair-raising corners, it's great to have these suggestions of how to act, how to negotiate our way through difficulties. So that's what that 10-point checklist is about. And so we were looking at how all that we are arises with our thoughts. Our thoughts make the world. Everything comes from our thoughts. That's kind of the main driver or motivator. And then our interface with the world is how we speak, our communication traits, how we communicate with others, but also our inner dialogue, that inner self-talk. And that inner dialogue actually is how we frame the world, how we describe the world to ourselves without even knowing it, and that makes our world. So there is kind of this spectrum, it's quite subtle. We know that there is quite a difference how we frame the world, it's a dependent arising, that if we have a problem and how we think about it and we just kind of go through and it may be quite, you know, depressed or destructive, and then we think, what would the Dalai Lama say? And how the Dalai Lama would express the same situation, even just thinking about it without even talking to His Holiness. Immediately in our mind, it's quite different, isn't it? So just how we frame the world, what words we use, what tone of voice we use, profoundly changes our experience. So that was the speech one. So then those of you who've been coming along for the previous classes, have you been doing any of the worksheets? Is there any questions that came up from last week about how we use our speech? Has anyone been doing the purification meditation practice using the four opponent powers? I'm giving you time to write in the chat. I know last week it was quite a big one, the one about the speech, because it is the way that we mostly relate with the world. And there's kind of no way to avoid it, is it, if we want to be with people and we need people. And even if we're not with people, we're with ourselves and we have the inner dialogue. So any questions? Oh, good. So the worksheets have been great. I'm glad you think they're great, because most people just say the worksheets have been challenging. reflective and revealing. And that's, I mean, I think we get to relish that feeling of spotting our discrepancies, of liking that feeling of revelation instead of being uncomfortable. It's kind of like fixing up a wound, isn't it? It's a bit of a relief. Oh, good. And Hosanna as well. That's great to hear. Excellent. The inner self-talk is a huge challenge. That's right. And Karen, it's because it drives itself, doesn't it? Because we're not aware of it. It gathers its own momentum. And then before we know it, it's hardwired in. So one of the ways immediately that we can do is to start putting in our own self-talk on purpose. So training in words. So that's why we have prayers and things in meditation, to get used to using different words. And then catching those, the strongest negativities that you notice within your own speech patterns and way of framing the world, and putting in a new way of saying it. And we have to be quite disciplined about it, but it's fun. You can keep a journal about it, so you can spot all the crazy things that our inner voice says, and then go, what's a more realistic way of putting it? Like, for instance, the one of thinking, oh, I'm so depressed. And then if you take a moment to remember how we reframe that one, we go, I am a budding Buddha undergoing depression. So you just need a few of those one-liners to train in those, and it changes everything. Oh, okay. So Stephen, a documentary, My Year of Living Mindfully. Yes. So I think that's on ABC, isn't it? So it might be worth checking out. That's kind of like, edging in from the Western point of view, a little bit like when, anthropologists go into the field and they're trying to figure out what on earth is going on with this tribe. So, you could just ask the tribe. So let's have a look. What we're going to look at today is physical activities of the body. So when we kind of put it in context, taming our mind definitely is a challenge. What's going on in our mind is a challenge. Our heart, our emotions, our attitudes and feelings. Luckily, most of that's private. Disciplining our speech takes effort, but it can be done. And it's really important that we do, because it's mostly how we relate. It's mostly public, isn't it? Our speech, that's how we spend most of the time relating to others. It's much easier in the context of mind and speech to clean up our actions, our physical expression. It's the easiest one to control. So restraining whatever destructive, negative physical actions, much easier than speech or mind. That's kind of why we've left it to the end, but it's also, if we want sustained change, we have to tackle the mind and then the speech first. Otherwise, if we just go straight to the easy one of changing our physical activities and trying to look all holy and calm, and we haven't changed what's going on inside, which may not be calm at all, it's not going to help us in the long term. It's just going to make us exhausted. So we've done the hard yards already in the previous two classes. And so this is just to make sure that we're on the right track physically with how we express ourselves and what we're doing in the world. Now, why are we here? Let's set our motivation, take a moment to focus why we're here. And our two questions that we normally do to start the class, what destructive physical behaviors do you have that harm yourself or others? So you might know what they are already. It might be to do with diet or exercise. It might be to do with violence or aggression. It could be to do with some kind of addiction or a compulsion. My go-to with this is if you kind of draw a blank with this one, then what have your friends or family told you is your problem? They probably know you pretty well. So a physical behavior, the one also that when we succumb to it, we really get down on ourselves. We get frustrated and we get demoralized and it ruins our self-esteem and we get judgmental or guilty, all of those things. So that's the negative side. Now the other side, the positive. What do our destructive behaviors stop us doing that we'd like to be doing? So if we just fritter our way money away on online shopping, for instance, and just end up with nothing at the end of each month, what's that stopping us doing? Well, it used to stop us going on an overseas trip, or it might stop you buying a new car, or it might stop you getting some fantastic books. So instead of just focusing on that negative, what's the bigger picture, the context of what are you being taken away from that you'd really love to be doing? So that's the context. Let's just do a little meditation to focus our mind. So sitting up, so as this is to do with our physical actions, let's just fix our posture. So kind of sitting up fairly straight. And really feeling your posture from the inside, that experience, and imagine a thread of light running up just in front of your spine, up through your body and out the crown of your head, and feel as if you're being suspended from your crown, all the weight of your body supported. Let your spine align. You might find that you sit back a little bit. You might also find if you're tipping to one side or the other. And if you're doing it right, you'll notice that your head just slightly tilts forward. If you spend a lot of time at a computer, make sure that your chin is tucked inwards. Let your shoulders drop. Let go of all the tension of the shoulders. Relax the jaw, teeth slightly apart, tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth, and a slight smile on your lips. And then release any tension from the forehead, the eyelids, the temples, and let your eyes just be slightly open and feel that your gaze becomes very broad and expansive, but focused inwards. Feel the stability of your posture, how you're supported by the earth, by the chair or the seat. And whatever was the reason that got you here this morning, that motivated you to come to this class, bring that to mind. Why are you here? Who do you want to benefit? What kind of benefit are you looking for? And then recognizing we are embodied beings. There is a profound interactive relationship between our body and our mind. And so whatever we do with this life and with this body, we want to have a long-term benefit of lasting happiness. And also we have so much power by having this body that we can harness that to bring a long-term benefit and happiness to everyone, starting with those immediately around us. But setting our motivation to be able to make the very most of this life, what we have, to being able to dismantle all of those destructive habits and release all of that energy, that positive energy that we have, positive potential. And from a Buddhist point of view, the potential that we have is to bring ultimate lasting happiness to ourselves and everybody. So with this big-hearted attitude, take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. And let's have a look at the topic then. So we're going to start off with a bit of an aggressive picture because we're looking at the non-virtuous physical actions. So no need to explain that picture, is there? So physical actions that bring actually long-term harm or suffering, and it's whether it's aggression towards others or self-harm. It's both counted as, you know, physical destructive action. So some things that we do with our body may be quite rough, but they may be needed. So, for instance, if a child's running out into traffic and you grab their arm and you pull them back, they might go, "Oh, you hurt me, you're horrible." So you may have actually hurt their arm, but you've saved them from being run over. So that's why I've got that thing of it brings long-term harm or suffering. And we may think that that's an obvious thing, but many times we protect people from the short-term harm at the expense of the long-term. So it's important to kind of keep this big picture. And aggression, even if we manage to restrain our aggression towards others, sometimes if we get so frustrated that we harm ourselves, that also it's no good. So there's a whole spectrum again of these physical activities, but the ones that we want to avoid, the very worst, the three main destructive actions that all the others kind of fit into, these are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Now, you know, we're probably quite relieved because we already avoid these, hopefully, largely. And in our culture, in Australia, it's very easy to avoid these. Our culture supports us not killing others. You know, we don't have a gun culture. No one's kind of walking around into supermarkets and cafes all armed up. So the killing thing, you know, where I just shudder in horror when I think about being in America and the amount of violence that is enabled just by having guns on the street, for instance. So our culture here really supports us being free from these. Even if we did want to go and kill somebody, we'd actually have to get quite organized to do it. Stealing as well, it's generally frowned upon culturally, and sexual misconduct as well. So because our culture supports refraining from these things, we're lucky. Many parts of the world, there's very little choice. So if you're in a country where there is no social safety net, where you have no legitimate form of income, where there's just fraud and corruption everywhere, and the only way that you can support your family is by stealing, what are you going to do? Or by lying to others or ripping others off to feed your own family, what are you going to do? It's really difficult when it comes to it. It's okay to have these highfalutin ideals, but when it actually comes to it, it can be quite a difficult decision to make. So we're lucky because very rarely do we have to make this decision. It's just easy. And because of that, then we don't give it enough appreciation that this is what we're doing. Also, we probably regret doing these actions naturally if we have the courage to recognize that we've done them instead of just kind of covering it up and going, oh, I meant to. Some of the physical actions, say, for instance, with killing, if you're a soldier and you go overseas and then you get post-traumatic stress syndrome, all of that physical harm and violence, you know, it gets hardwired into your nervous system. So if we actually can even learn how to deal with that, then we can stop a whole world of harm. So let's have a look at what they are. So to avoid killing. So what do we actually abandon? So we abandon murder and abortion, which is killing a human being, though not a fully developed one. Avoid also then not just killing, but physical harm. So torturing others or aggressive intimidation, controlling others through violence. So they're the main ones. Killing another human being is counted as being really terrible because of the amount of potential that you're cutting off is huge. And what we have is this terrible situation where in a culture that normalizes violence, then it becomes very easy to do. It becomes like an accepted thing, retaliation and then violence. So what makes violence or aggression negative is the motivation, the intention to harm. So we recognize that in our legal system, don't we? There's a big difference between murder and manslaughter. And every now and again, someone will do a terrible thing like back out of their driveway and run over their own child. So that's, you know, clearly not counted as murder, is it? And yet the child has died. So there we can see that there is a huge difference in the motivation. That's actually the deciding factor. The motivation is secondary to even the action of killing. So then also with abortion, because you're taking the life of a human being, you're cutting off all that potential. A human life is so rare in terms of all the other life forms on the planet and what a human life can do, which is become a Buddha and then liberate others, and you're cutting off that potential. So many times we may not in our culture have a choice. We may not be educated, or we may just go straight to the extreme instead of thinking, I'll have the child and put them up for adoption, for instance. So it's always a complex issue, but we're just looking at the kind of potential that we're cutting off. Now, the other thing with violence too is that there is a whole spectrum of just from physical intimidation, I suppose, and they're all motivated by this disturbing emotions and by fear and helplessness, but it comes out as aggression. The other thing too is that it's whether we do it or we get somebody else to do it. So if we get somebody else to do our dirty work, if we don't want to kill our husband as revenge and we get a hitman to kill our husband, now there's two people. Now it's doubly bad. It's not that you've dodged a bullet. Now both of you are implicated. There's also what I found in our culture, a real the macho culture of the only way that we can express strength is through violence or aggression. So if you're frustrated, you express it physically, or if you're going to stand up for yourself, you express it with violence. And so that difference between aggression and being assertive, it's just all mixed in there. And nobody is taught at school how to be strong without being violent, how to be strong without retaliation in there. It's just conflated together as if it's the same thing. How to be strong without being aggressive, even just with our speech. How to release frustration and tension without it being aggressive and harmful. So what happens, particularly in our Australian culture, is that relief and violence get hardwired together, until it's inconceivable that there is any other way to get rid of that violent, that frustrated feeling, unless it's with violence. So there is a lot in this one, you know, at least if we can say, okay, I'm not going to kill another human being. But then there is this whole spectrum. So what to practice instead is to try and save lives or protect others, protect the vulnerable. Just going to check that question. So a question about abortion. So if the baby wasn't going to survive, well then, I mean, in a way, our incredibly advanced medical system has made things more difficult, because if a baby was going to be born deformed and only live a few days and die, then it was just a natural thing. There wasn't any decision to be made there. But now we have all at the beginning of life and at the end of the life, all of these ways to keep people alive, where actually what's the quality of life going to be? So it makes those decisions actually much more difficult. But as with everything, how we make that decision is, what's our primary motivation? Our primary motivation is to be kind, to protect others. And so, say, for instance, at the end of life, when you're talking about euthanasia, people get painkillers and they're given painkillers to relieve pain, not to kill them. But eventually, one of those doses of painkillers may actually kill them as a side effect. And everybody knows this, but you're not given the painkillers to kill. You don't kill grandma. You give her pain relief. And then one day it tips over the edge and grandma dies. So the motivation, though, is to relieve suffering and not to kill them. So it's quite easy, that one. We can really delude ourselves by thinking, oh, I'm trying to relieve grandma's pain, so now I'm going to kill her. That's being delusional. Instinctually, you know, everybody wants to be able to live and to be free of suffering. So that's what we have to protect. And not just take the easy way. So most of the time, how we act, we're acting on what's going to make us feel better. We're not actually looking at the big situation. So what to practice instead? Saving lives, helping to protect. So donating to all sorts of charities, giving blood, trying to maybe even donating to charities that help people with anger management classes or defensive driving classes, women's refuges. Trying to protect people, help them improve their physical situation, help them live longer, healthier lives. So anything like that that enhances physical well-being. So at the moment, you know, doing food drop-offs to help the homeless, giving blankets now that winter's come, really simple things like that that are the opposite of physical harm, now physical protection and help. Even just helping drive someone to the shops or carrying their shopping for them, or giving them a massage or just a soft touch. Social isolation included. And the other thing about this is that actually refraining from harm counts. And this social isolation, it's kind of difficult to recognize that this is actually the opposite of killing, because by staying home, even though we're not overtly doing some physical activity, we are saving lives. By social isolating, staying 1.5-2 meters apart, that is our offering to others of long life. It's more difficult for us to recognize because it's not an overt thing, but it is just as powerful. The refraining from harm is just as powerful as the helping. And it's really been quite a challenge for the medical community and the government to get this across, because we forget, because we can't see anything concrete in front of us, we forget that just by staying home, we're contributing to the welfare of others. So I think there's one ad on TV that's talking about the WHO's 5 heroic acts, and one of them is staying home. Who'd have thought that's part of this avoiding killing? So then the benefits of this is that we have a long life without illness. In the future, we're born with an intuitive sense of kindness. So, you know, little kitties, some little kitties, they're the ones that come home with all the broken animals from the side of the road, and the little insect with his missing leg or whatever, and mummy, you know, let's help them. Where does that come from? That comes from already doing this. Other little kitties are born with this glee of stomping on insects and feeling the squish or the crunch. That comes from having killed in the past and having a liking for it. So there's kind of like this echo into the next life. So if we want to have an intuitive sense of kindness, it starts by actually practicing it, of protecting the vulnerable. Also part of protecting the vulnerable is if we know someone is being intimidated or bullied or sexually abused, to really try and get online and do some research of what's the best thing to do here. How can I really help? Who should I tell? How should I go about it? And to you be the one that actually starts resolving that situation, because there's nothing worse than just turning a blind eye or thinking somebody else will fix it or it's not that bad or something like that. So we have to be smart about it, but also there's a lot of information now of how to go about this. So in particular, protecting the vulnerable, those that, you know, the old and the young and the sick, the disabled from being abused. It's so important. It's ordinary people like us that have to be able to do that. All right. So, yes, the benefits. And also we find ourselves then when we avoid violence or physical harm, we find ourselves with help and support easily. We easily are helped and supported. And that's what we all want, isn't it? But normally we try to get that by forcing other people to help us. But this is the way to do it, by actually creating that kind of environment around us first, creating harmony. Okay, so then the next one, avoiding stealing. So what is stealing? It means that we're taking things either owned by individuals, by people, or by groups, so by a business. And actually, karmically, if you steal some paper from work, it's far worse than just stealing some paper from a person, say from your neighbour, because if you're stealing from your work, you're stealing from all those people. The group is bigger. If you're cheating on your taxes, you're stealing from all of the Australian populace that relies on taxes for all of the benefit. So it might give you pause. Late payment of bills is an interesting one. So it's not that you're actually taking money from somebody, but you're withholding giving them money that's theirs. So you see, whilst we may not overtly be stealing, there are these grey areas that we can tidy up. And it means that then our own life becomes much clearer and our way forward much clearer. Theft also includes getting other people to steal stuff for you, or borrowing with no intention to return the thing. So when I found that out, I was in my early 20s and living in various share houses and things, and we'd all borrow each other's clothes to go out. And I borrowed my friend's silk black velvet cape. I was a goth, right? So a black velvet cape, but a silk one from the 30s. So just, you know, exquisitely cut. And I borrowed it with no intention of giving it back. And I knew. So I bullied into it, letting me have it. And of course, I think I had it for like 2 or 3 years. Then I went to a teaching, and when the Lama said, borrowing with no intention to return, I just went, oh no. I have to fess up to this. And so I actually posted it back to her, and she was absolutely gobsmacked. She couldn't believe it, that because she knew and she'd kind of given up, and it made her so happy that she finally got her black cape back again. And it was such a relief for me. That was the other thing. And I had no idea that it had been gnawing away at me constantly, unconsciously, and I had no idea for all those years until I posted it back, and suddenly I felt different. I felt free. Wow. So this one, theft, that's it's a pretty difficult one to give up, but just because it's just motivated by our constant craving. What to practice instead? So the opposite is generosity. But generosity, remember, generosity isn't the things. Generosity is the intention. So we have the intention to share or to give. That's the act of generosity. The thing that you're giving, say $10, that's the substance of generosity, but it's not generosity. It's just the substance of it. So don't get sucked into thinking, oh, I've stolen all of these things, so to make up, I have to give away all of my things. That's just the substance of it. So you give according to your means. Whatever you have that's appropriate for you to give, you give. But you have this intention, this big-heartedness of wanting to share. So it's very pragmatic in a way. And what Geshe-la has said many times is you think what you can comfortably give without regretting, and then just a little bit more, just stretch it a little bit, not a big bit, just a little bit. So if you're walking along and there's a beggar on the street and you've got, say, some gold coins, and a gold coin donation isn't going to worry you, then maybe do a $2 gold coin donation, or maybe give $2.50. If $1 was going to be easy, maybe do $1.50. Don't kind of go give the $10 and really hope and then come home and regret, because regretting your generosity is even worse, because it's regretting virtue. That's a terrible thing to do. It's even worse in a way than just not giving anything. So give according to your means, and how you figure it out, it's really contextual. It's going to change according to your circumstances. So you've got to kind of be honest with yourself. And the way to do that that's really easy is to recognize, I would love to give you my entire life savings to help you, but I know tomorrow I'm going to totally regret that. So this is what I can comfortably give. And tomorrow I'll feel even better about having given that. So I have relatives overseas in Latvia, you know, in the Baltic states. And so they're quite a sophisticated culture, but they're very poor. They've been very poor for a long, long time. So my relatives, they work in galleries and museums and whatever, but they live in this farmhouse that has no running water. they have a hose outside that they do the dishes in the lawn. You know, Latvia gets down to minus 10 degrees regularly. So it's really difficult. So I wanted to send them some money. And this is because I visited them, I saw how they were living. So then I had to figure out, well, you know, I'm actually not that rich either, but what's the context here? So it took me a while to figure out what I could give that I'd be really happy to give, that then I wouldn't regret later on. So I did send them some money, and they were so cute. They emailed me back and said, "Oh, you're such a good fairy." I think they meant fairy godmother. Anyway, I'm a good fairy. And, you know, that was like a while ago now, and now I still think about having sent them some money. I've never been able to send people money in my life before because I've never had any. But now every time I think about it, I get happy and I think, well, at least I did something useful with it. So that's how you can tell, because you go back to it and you just feel even better. So give to causes and things that inspire you, so that even if you may not be able to do the thing, even if you may not be able to cure cancer, you can give to the cancer research. And then every time you think about it, you feel good. And that's authentic happiness, because you're rejoicing about all the positive things that can come from it, not craving happiness. But there's other things that you can give as well. So it doesn't just have to be things or stuff or money. Offering our time, ringing somebody up, having a Skype call or a Zoom call, and spending time together like that, that's a generous offering. When someone's really needy and we might kind of shy away, we can't stand that neediness, to just kind of relax and think, I'm going to give you my undivided attention for a full half hour with no resentment, with no getting ants in my pants, I've got to go now, I can't bear all of this moaning and groaning. Just think, I'm going to offer you my time, my undivided attention. That's an act of generosity. And it can really help too, because if people who are really, really needy and they're not getting what they need, and they sense that resentment of when they're trying to wheedle time out of people. But if you give your time and your heart freely, they also sense that and think, you know, it makes a difference to their heart. Then also, of course, giving education, that's a big one. So from a Buddhist point of view, giving the Dharma, giving the means out of suffering. But even just helping someone to learn to read, showing someone how to use a computer, showing someone how to use Zoom. That's a really huge gift of generosity, to educate others, to give them freedom. And then the benefits. So the benefits of practicing generosity is that wealth easily comes to you. So isn't that counterintuitive? You know, we get so tight, oh, I don't have enough, so we hold on more and more and more. And while we may be able to hold on to our money or our stuff for a bit, our sense of safety does not, that doesn't grow. We don't feel comfortable. And you just look at those millionaires and billionaires, they don't feel they have enough, because they haven't got that attitude, the open-hearted attitude. So even they've got all that money, it's not enough. It's such a waste and it's such a tragedy. So practicing generosity means that we create this environment around us where help comes easily. When we need resources, they come easily to us. People are happy to share and to help us. So before I came to Lungri Tumpa Centre, I lived by myself. I had my own business and I was dirt poor, literally. It was so hard. Being an artist in Australia, it's really hard. And so I got really uptight about not having enough money and not having enough food. And I was skinny because I didn't have enough food. And I did figure out, though, that just holding on to everything and not sharing wasn't the way to go. That if you shared, then people were happy to share with you. But I really learned that one through trial and error. So people would come over at dinner time because they were poor, and I'd go, well, I've only got enough food in the fridge for a few days, so do I cook everybody dinner and now I don't have anything to eat for 3 days, or do we all just sit around and dinner time comes and goes and we're all just hungry and I pretend I'm vague and forgot to cook dinner and then I have food for the next 3 days? So I tried both options, and it's kind of interesting that while it's your stomach's happy if you have food for the next 3 days, your heart isn't. Your heart's not comfortable. And probably the way that you could get into a real nasty chain reaction is your heart feels uncomfortable, your conscience is not happy, so then you want to get more. You want to hold on to more, and it's a vicious circle. So I found through trial and error, it's actually better to share and to just not have any food for the next 3 days and just go and visit your friends for dinner the next day. When I came to Lungri Tungpa Centre, everything changed because I'm volunteering at Lungri Tungpa Centre, then suddenly people started bringing us food and dinner just unbidden by themselves. And I was just amazed. This is it. How is this even happening? And it's just because when you give of yourself, other people like to support you. It just happens that way. You do find yourself with enough resources. So it's not that we were starving, of course. It's just that I'm a hopeless cook. So I think people took pity on me. So, yeah, we end up with enough resources when we create this open, generous atmosphere. That's the way for that long term. All right, now the next one. Avoiding sexual misconduct. Now you'd think this would be easy enough to avoid, and yet look at the main subject matter of all the movies and the TV shows out and everything. It pretty much focuses around cheating, doesn't it? Cheating on your partner or cheating with somebody else's partner. How many movies where someone sleeps with their best friend's wife or husband? You know, they spend a bit of time with them, they get attracted, they sleep with their mate's husband or wife. No one does that thinking, I'm going to ruin the friendship of a lifetime. And yet it happens over and over and over again. You sleep with your best friend's wife or husband, and then you might have an affair, quite a short affair. Usually that affair finishes within months, weeks or months, and then you no longer have the object of your desire, the person you're having the affair with, and you no longer have your friend of a lifetime. So if it was just a matter of an intellectual thing, we would understand this, but that's not enough, is it? And it's because we're driven by attachment. We're driven by our short-term wants, needs, cravings at the expense of long-term happiness. Sexual misconduct can also include abuse, coercion, rape in marriage. From the Buddhist point of view, those actions, though, are more to do with maliciousness, because they're motivated by wanting to harm the other, or being very indifferent to the other. So the one with sexual misconduct is usually motivated by attachment and craving. So when it comes to things like hate crimes and rape, that's actually more on the side of maliciousness than sexuality, because it's more to do with harm and with power than it is to do with pleasure. And Western psychology kind of describes it this way as well. But with this one, sexual misconduct that is motivated by just desire, desirous attachment, our culture has a real double standard about this, doesn't it? Because while all the politicians, everyone talks about family values, blah, 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 they're all having affairs on the side. And our culture supports this by, I mean, remember it was a couple of years ago, those ads on TV for Ashley Martin was this dating site, and their tagline was, "Life is short, have an affair." I kid you not, that was their actual advertising on primetime television. I couldn't believe that happened, especially not when you have kind of a government that talks about family values, and yet you have all of this kind of stuff on TV. So what happened with Ashley Martin, I think someone hacked into their database of everybody who wanted to have an affair and was exposed all the names of those people. And so some of the people who were exposed committed suicide. So the whole thing was just started off badly and it got worse. Someone in one of the last classes said, what about MAFS, Married at First Sight, and all those other kind of soft porn TV shows, desert island things, all of these young people in bikinis on a desert island. Now let's see if they don't sleep together. So it's all there. There's a huge business, money-making business there just on those TV shows. And so, of course, that changes the tone of our culture, and it's our culture is us, because that's what, as a culture, we're interested in. So what to practice instead? The whole opposite of sexual misconduct is actually respect, really respecting the personal boundaries of others, respecting others when they're vulnerable, when they cannot stand up for themselves. So respecting women who may not be able to stand up for themselves, who aren't necessarily physically strong enough, who don't get away with all the things that the guys get away with, but nevertheless showing respect to the vulnerable. So in a way, it's like a crude way of saying this is showing respect when you don't have to, because normally we respect the ones that are more powerful than us because we're scared. But do we respect the ones that are vulnerable, that are less powerful than us? Doing whatever we can to support relationships, to enhance harmonious relationships, to create harmony. So really trying to help others in their relationships to create an atmosphere of trust. And when it comes to the law, you know, if there are unfair laws, lobby to change the laws. So Australia got marriage equality, finally. So that's a really good outcome, isn't it, to protect the vulnerable like that, to actually get some equality instead of a double standard. I mean, marriage of two people deciding to support each other for the rest of their life has been along way before any religion. I'm sure the Neanderthals had some form of marriage, of getting together. So, you know, just that kind of equality, if we can work to change the law. I think also in Tasmania, was just in the 80s that being homosexual was decriminalised. So you could be sent to jail in the 80s. So that's one way, that the opposite of sexual misconduct, we may not be cheating on anybody, but to really try and change our culture, the laws of our land, that's the opposite. And in terms of protecting the vulnerable, another thing that I'd like to say about this with sexual misconduct, so when it comes to, say, child abuse or sexual abuse in the in the workplace. Many times, how come this continues is that the people in positions of power or authority protect the institution, not the individual. So I remember years ago, Lama Yeshe talking about just Dharma centers, and he said, first come the students, then comes the center. So simple, isn't it? First come the benefit of the students, then comes the benefit of the center, the institution. And if we keep that in our mind, we'll never go wrong. So I found that just that one liner profoundly useful for me, because if there's ever been any kind of complaint about Lungri Tumpa Center, one part of me goes, oh, protect Lungri Tumpa Center, but the main part of me goes, Lama Yeshe said, the students first. So if someone has a complaint, it's like they are number one, because actually they are the center. Who is the center apart from the students anyway? Who is the church apart from the parishioners anyway? So protecting the institution first, that's wrong. And that way, all other harms follow. So in a way, how can we do that? Well, because we have pride. We identify with our peer group, our cohort. So if someone, for instance, has a complaint about Lungri Tumpa Center, I feel it's a complaint about me. If someone... If a teacher in a school hears, oh, a teacher has been abusing a child or molesting a child, the instinctual response, and this is many studies have borne this out, is for the teacher to feel to side with the other teacher, because me and mine, I'm also a teacher. And so the first response, the instinctual response, is to go, oh, no, it couldn't be. They couldn't possibly. Because we don't identify with the vulnerable, we identify with me and mine. So how do we guard against this instinctual kind of protection against me or mine? To turn a blind eye in the family, no, they couldn't possibly. Or as a teacher, oh, no, they couldn't possibly. Or a school coach, they couldn't possibly. Is to always look after the vulnerable first over the institution. It's just the most amazing rule of thumb. So if we can do that, not just avoid the harm but protect the vulnerable, what we end up with is harmonious relationships that last a long time, functional families. So when I was growing up and all the share houses that I live with, I don't think I knew one person that grew up with a father. It was just a whole generation of absentee fathers. They weren't there. Either the parents had split up or the father was a workaholic and never spent any time at home. So fathers just weren't, they just didn't even figure. They just weren't there. And so then, of course, having long-term relationships is like, well, what does that even mean and what does that even look like? We never kind of go into a relationship going, it'll be great if it didn't last. We just instinctively want to have good relationships that last a long time. We want to have friends that we can rely on for a long time. So this is how we go about it. Not just kind of hoping, but we can actually put in place the inner environment for really good relationships. And then we'll find that we actually have many friends and we have good quality friends. And we have harmonious relationships at home. Because the same thing, just like protecting the vulnerable at home, in our family also, it's not just the family as an institution. It's like looking after the weakest link. They need the most care. But often, I think I might have mentioned this last week as well, we might be quite polite to strangers and we're quite rude to our family. So our way of being with people, of caring for others or showing care, is to do with pride, with saving face, putting on a good show. And many domestic abusers do this. they'll be very friendly and nice to everybody. And so no one can imagine that they're abusing their partner at home. So because we're at home and we're familiar with others, if we haven't actually developed our care for them, if we haven't developed love for them instead of just attachment, if we're not thinking about their welfare, we just disrespect them. We're just rude. You know, we come in and we grunt and we don't say anything. It's like, whatever. But if a visitor came, it's, oh, hello, how are you? So how come we don't go home and go, good morning, how are you? As a human being this morning, here's a cup of tea. I hope you have a really good day. Give people some space. So we've all had to learn how to get some space, haven't we, now in social isolation, because we're all been at home. And this has been a make or break, hasn't it? Can we actually give each other space emotionally while we're physically together? And the only way that can happen is by showing some respect. And so usually we also just show respect. If somebody else respects me, I'll respect them. But if they're rude to me, all bets are off. I'm rude back. But actually, we have to respect the ones that are rude. It's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? But if we want people to stop being rude, how is that going to happen if we're rude back? So that's a double standard right there. So for those who are disrespecting us, that's when we show respect first. And what that's doing actually is that we're now relating to their good self. We're not relating to their bad behavior. We're relating to their potential. And that's also what Lama Yeshe did all the time. It's why everybody loved being in teachings with Lama Yeshe, because you just felt good. And why? Because he was talking to your potential, to everything that you could be. So you kind of naturally grew into it. So before we go on to the next bit, any questions or comments at all? Have a look. Nothing yet. Well, please put them in the chat if you have. So if we can avoid sexual misconduct and if we can protect the vulnerable and respect others, then naturally we'll have really good quality relationships. We'll feel safe and supported. So let's have a look then just generally how our behavior defines us, because our habitual activities in the end become, you know, who we are. It's how we're remembered. It's our habits. We become our habits. Our habits develop their own momentum, and then they determine how we experience what happens to us. They compel us to act in various ways. So let's have a look at various ways what we, the destructive behavior and the positive, and if you've got any of these in the list, and also how strong they are. We might find that we've got the destructive habits and they're really strong. The positive habits, we only got a few and they're not very strong. But at least if we can identify them, we do something about it. So just in no apparent order, online gaming, surfing the net, social media when you're really bored, addiction to Facebook. So all that kind of sucked into the screen. Also not just online gambling, but just going out and gambling. So gambling, even though it's not like a physical drug that you take, you do become addicted in the same way as, say, to cocaine or heroin. Exactly the same process happens in your brain. So it's not to be underestimated, an incredibly destructive habit. So with any of these physical habits, when they're addictive, physically, we've got a double whammy. We've got the physical addiction as well as the emotional one that's been driving it. Then we have all of the habits of excess, overeating, oversleeping, compulsive sexual activity. So we can either die from excess or we die from a lack. And many times in our culture, the guys tend to die from excess, too much sex, too many fast cars, too much alcohol, too much money, too much success. And the women tend to die from the lack of things. So not enough support, not enough food, not enough power, not enough money. But either way, extreme. So whatever the substance abuses or dependencies, common ones being alcohol, of course, because again, there's that conflation of the only way many people know how to relax is through a drug, whether it's having a cigarette, having a drink, smoking a bong, whatever it is, that the state of relaxation can only come through a physical activity. And so they get fused together in your mind and in your brain. Whereas there are countless other ways to relax and feel good, but because we're not educated about it, we just go straight to the external substance. And then that has physical toxic effects on us. Whatever compulsive activity, shopping, gambling, hoarding. So hoarding is a universal thing, but if you're in a poor country, you don't actually get the opportunity. Because we're in a country of just throw away cheap things, $2 shops, once the $2 shops started happening in, what was it, in the 90s, then the boom in self-storage happened and hoarding exploded. Before that, people just hoarded newspapers. After that, people hoard everything. Compulsions, compulsive email checking, compulsive counting. I put in here compulsive hand washing, but actually that's probably a good thing now in the time of COVID, because my parents, my brother and sister's uncle is a compulsive hand washer. And, you know, we might think that's a bad thing. He had peeling hands and everything all the time. But he lived in a share house, and the people in the share house got COVID. So he'd be around to my parents all the time. They're elderly. But because of his compulsive hand washing, nobody else got COVID. It was amazing. Thank goodness. Well, that would have been it for my family on that side. Okay, behavior that defines us, violent or aggressive outbursts, destroying things, that kind of aggression, destroying one's possessions. So you might recognize some of these. You might know them in others. You might know them in yourself. So what can we do instead? Well, we've got to stop the negative behavior and then put in place a positive one to fill the vacuum. So some positive things, just taking a bath, going for a walk, even if you hate exercise, going for a walk, because you're changing the view, the surroundings and the atmosphere, so then you change within as well. Swimming is great. And dancing, go out and learn cha-cha-cha. So it might be something very profound, but it is positive. There's connection with others. Maybe you can't, with social distancing, go out and learn cha-cha-cha at the moment, but I'm sure there's a Zoom thing that you can do it on. You can dance with the dog or the teddy bear. And especially if you're really stuck in your head and you get quite obsessive about things, and you might be hopeless at dancing, just going out and learning it is really great. It's actually fun. And because it starts rewiring your brain in different ways, a whole lot of other benefits flow from it. Of course, if you're a Buddhist, do prostrations. Create mountains of merit at the same time as getting fit. Taking up a hobby. So hobbies, crochet, gardening, woodwork, cooking, all of those things, they're not going to profoundly change the world necessarily, but they're working with our hands. So when you work with your hands, you release endorphins in your brain. The happy drug in your brain naturally happens just by working with your hands. So just that, why not? But also, if you're just a little bit disciplined about it, when you do something that you love doing, so this is what I've done with crochet. I've associated crochet now with positive thoughts. So I sit down and I crochet, and as I start crocheting, automatically I start saying the refuge prayer, the bodhicitta prayer. I start thinking about who I'm crocheting it for. I start wishing them happiness, wishing them free of suffering, wishing them liberation and enlightenment. And it all just naturally flows because I've set it up that way. So I have heard in the past that, you know, there were, say, crochet groups or sewing groups, and they were called stitch and bitch, which is the opposite, isn't it? So you'd sit down, you'd do something with your hands, and you'd just bitch about everybody. So that's no good. You go to crochet to create harmony, to draw the strands of your life together, to create something out of nothing. So with just a little bit of mindfulness at the beginning, you can do any of these hobbies. And when you're gardening, you can be thinking about karma. You can be thinking about putting in place all of the positive seeds to develop your strengths and your qualities and enjoy them. And just as you're planting these seeds, may you plant the seeds of virtue in your mind. May you bring joy and happiness to others, just like you're creating this beautiful environment of a garden. And because we're physically doing it, and then we mentally couple it with all of these good thoughts in our mind, it becomes very powerful. Cooking as well. Cooking can be a beautiful creative outlet and an act of generosity to others. But if you're cooking and you're getting all stressed and full of expectations and wanting everybody to praise you for it and getting upset when it didn't turn out, you kind of missed the point there. The main point of cooking isn't the food. The main point of cooking is sharing. What else? So then we do thought transformation on the daily chores, like cooking, for instance, or washing up. You know, you do it for others. You think, just by me scrubbing these pots and pans, may I scrub out all of my disturbing states of mind. No wonder it's hard. So you can't avoid the chores, so make them part of the path to enlightenment, to self-actualization. And learning a new skill, a musical instrument, joining a choir, volunteering, all of those things have a profound effect on the rest of our life, as we know. It's not about having to be perfect, but just the actual activity of connectedness and creating something. The more reflective things like meditation, reading, painting, journaling. Also, getting a pet, someone else to look after. We just need to look after one other being, and everything changes. So do it for others. It doesn't necessarily have to be for everybody, just one other to start with. A cat or a dog, a fish or a bird. It's so profound. So they even found in old people's homes, just having a mechanical cat or dog when they couldn't have a real one, just the act of looking after them changed the whole state of well-being of those old people. And keeping a journal, journaling is good. That's that interface again between the inner dialogue, but it's the physical act of writing it down or typing it out, of pinning it down like that, of self-reflection, that actually does the change. And whether you actually just write down your shopping list or you write down what you've been thinking or feeling, both have an effect on us because it's the act of putting the words out there. And what I didn't put on this list, but I will, is also something like boxing, martial arts. So you channel your aggression and your violence. You harness it. You learn to work with it. And it's not so much about destroying the other person as developing a skill. So at first we might think, oh, boxing is violent or martial arts is violent, but actually you can't be a good boxer or you can't be good at martial arts if you're violent. you'll just be beaten. You have to be able to harness your power and your fear. Okay, so then we get to the kicker. Yo, represent. So when we think about our physical, our body, we are not just our body, we're so much more. We're not just our body, and we are much more than our body. So one of the things that we just assume, a lot of the time we think we're our body. We think this is us, but it's not, it's our body. And actually, our body only represents us. It isn't even us. So here, do you know what this means? We're only 8% us. So that means if you count up all of the cells in the body, it's a ratio of 1 to 8, actually. So for each one cell in our body that's us, there are 8 cells that are other organisms. So when you look at this body, it's actually mostly not me. It's all of the organisms that keep our body alive, all the organisms that help us digest, all the little mites on our skin that mean we don't suffocate. All the different types of mites. So you have different ones on your nose, which is why sometimes you get an itchy nose on the top. And alcoholics have this red nose because it's all the little mites on the nose. It makes it inflamed. You have the mites on the skin. Means you don't suffocate. They clean your skin for you. So 1%, one cell us, 8 them. So actually we are walking condominiums. Isn't that amazing? So as a Buddhist, when you eat dinner, for instance, you offer to all the beings in your body, countless, as an act of generosity, may they be in my first circle of disciples when I become a Buddha. It's an incredible amount of generosity right there, and they're keeping us alive so we can have this life. It's so extraordinary. The other thing that I think is that we are this mix between of consciousness and collaboration. It's nice, isn't it? We rely on the kindness of others, of all of these organisms, just to be alive. You know, we have organisms, different ones in our ears, all the different gut flora and fauna. It's just becoming apparent now in our medical system of how important that is to have this balance and have the good ones in there. So, you know, we think this is us, but actually so much more. But the other thing about how our body represents us, this thing, have you heard, body dysmorphia? So what we have neurologically, we have an idea or a map of our body that's laid on our body. And what we relate to is this map of our body. We kind of have this idea, for instance, of how old we feel. And sometimes that map of our body, we don't even know that that's what we're relating to until it becomes disjointed with how our actual body is. So if you've ever watched Funniest Home Videos and the old people you know, doing something or other and tripping over and trying to do some sexy 60s dance or something and tripping over and hurting themselves. So that's because the body map that they have is still young, but the body's kind of degenerated, and it's a big shock. And it's why it happens. It's why we go to do something and we can no longer do it and we injure ourselves. So our body map doesn't quite match. Other times, you know, we have an idea of our body image, our body map on us if you're anorexic. So the body map that you have is a fat one. And that's actually what you experience, that you're fat, even though you're a walking skeleton. There's this discrepancy there, body dysmorphia. Phantom limb syndrome is the same thing. So if you have an accident and you lose your limb, because your body map still has a limb, it hasn't adjusted yet neurologically, you have phantom limb pain where your arm that is no longer there is hurting you. So what do you do then? Like, how do you amputate an arm that is not there? How do you treat an arm that is not there? So you treat the body map. So most of the time we have this map and we're not even aware of it till it goes wrong. When it does go wrong, it's handy to recognize, oh, this is because we are this collaboration of all the organisms that make us be able to stay alive, how our physical systems work, and our map, our image of who we are. And then that all depends on our environment and our diet. We think this is me. Actually, it's representing us. And this body means having this body that we represent others as well, whether we're aware of it or not. So we represent entire sections of society. In fact, we have so much power and we have no idea. So I'll give you a few ideas about this one, that if you're a woman and you're driving, how you drive, you're representing all women drivers. So if you have a smash with someone, someone's going to think women drivers from one woman. We overgeneralize. If we're Australian and we go overseas, whether we are aware of it or not, we represent Australia. How we are is how other people will relate with Australians. And when I go up to Carindale to do the shopping, I represent Buddhists. So this is a really heavy responsibility, isn't it? Because for years and years I've gone to Carindale and bought like a whole trolley of soy milk, bananas and chocolate. And the checkout chicks have looked at me and gone, what kind of diet is this? But it's the offerings for Pooja. So I've had to say to them, I don't actually subsist on soy milk, bananas and chocolate. This is offerings for a Buddhist center. Oh, right. And so now I have to be very, very good. I can't have a bad day and be grumpy because not only do I represent the Buddhist center in Camp Hill, I represent all Buddhists. In fact, I represent the Buddha. So whether I appreciate that power or not, it's there. That's how people react. If you're, you know, you think about your own parents, how your mother was or how your father was represents all mothers or all fathers. The kind of relationship that you had with your mother, that's how you think of mothers. You hear about all mother sentient beings, and if you didn't have a good relationship with your mother, you can't even relate to the term all mother sentient beings, because the one person represents everybody. And so we too, if you're a parent, how you are to your children, you're not just representing you or even being a parent, you are representing all parents everywhere forever. So this is a huge amount of power right there in our hands, and we don't even know that we have, and we can harness it to benefit others. It really shows how we have this universal responsibility, doesn't it? And with universal responsibility and universal power, how we are in the world affects others, affects everybody. So how can we feel all meek and helpless and hopeless when we have this power just from having a life, a body? And the thing, as with everything, so with physical exercise, if you don't use it, you lose it. That's what they've been saying about getting old. And I'm thinking, oh, I wonder if I've got a bit of time yet or not, because I don't feel like doing any exercise yet. But apparently if you don't exercise, then you lose all the muscles. If you don't stretch your legs in yoga or whatever, then you no longer can touch your toes. it's even more so with our ethics. If we don't use the power of our life to make really good choices and to protect others and help others, then we lose that ability to act ethically, to be able to make choices. So just as physically we need to keep our body strong and healthy by using it in the right way, same way with how we represent, we have to have practice at that as well. So do you have any questions about that, about the profound effect of being an embodied being has in the world or on you? Not yet. Well, hopefully I'll see it flashing up if it does. So, the worst actions that we can do physically, killing another living being, especially killing a human being, stealing, sexual misconduct. So they're really obvious things. They're fairly easy to avoid. In our culture, we have a lot of options available to us. We don't have to go to this extreme in order to survive. We just have to think about the disastrous consequences, and it usually stops us carrying it out. It's much easier to avoid because our culture supports us. And not only that, our culture supports us to refrain from these negative actions, but it also supports us to become a positive force in the world, because not only is it frowned upon to kill others, now we also have an opportunity that we can save lives. We can donate to paramedics or bushfire funds or koala funds or whatever. Everything also that way is set up and organized. It's very easy for us to contribute to the world in a positive way. Oh, good. So, Stephen, using the power of the Dharma to help others, especially your family, well, that's the place we've got to start, isn't it? Not I'm going to help all sentient beings or save people on the other side of the world and then being horrible to our family. We have to start with our nearest and dearest, those who we interact with every day. So the people that we know and love, the ones we live with, then the ones we work with, the ones we spend time with, whether we like them or not. That's where we have to put into practice first. That will have the immediate effect on us as well. And, of course, it takes effort because we're going against lifetimes and even generations of negative habits. But especially with these physical activities, it just takes one person to break that negative chain reaction. It just takes, even if you come from a family where there's been a huge amount of domestic violence or abuse, it just takes one person. It can stop with you. So, you know, Eddie's family, which is quite a large family and a lot of abuse in the family, really violent upbringing, and also sexual abuse with the girls, and most of Eddie's siblings have grown up and had kids, and the abuse has stopped with them. So, you know, it's hard because it's the habits of generations coming down upon us, but then it just takes one person to stop that abuse. And Eddie was saying, well, you know, his dad was really abusive. Well, he was Dutch, and he came from an incredibly difficult, abusive background in Holland. And probably his dad came from an even worse, impoverished, abusive background. And so it goes on back to the ages. And so there's this momentum that kind of gets visited upon us, but it just takes us and we can stop it. And my mother too. So she also suffered abuse in her childhood, And who knows what her parents suffered or her uncle suffered, but it stopped with her. And so I was free of that. And I count myself as so lucky, because many of my peer group weren't free of physical or sexual abuse. And I was freed from that. And that just took one person. So we can do that, incredible big force in the world. Now, we've got a little bit of time. I wanted to do this meditation. The four opponent powers. So it'll only take a few minutes. What I'd like you to do is think back over the class, what we've talked about, and you probably would have recognized now some negative habits that you have, physical ones, destructive physical compulsions or activities or addictions, ways of expressing yourself or communicating, you know, aggressively. So instead of feeling guilty about that or trying to hide them, let's do something about it. And it's worth taking a moment to regret whatever those negative physical actions are, because we can do something about it. We don't have to hide it. It's worth feeling the grief, the harm, recognizing the harm now, how it harms you, how it harms others, because now we can do something about it. I think that by doing this purification for ourselves, it's also going to benefit others, because we will become a safe person to be with. So our reliance, someone or something bigger and better than us, Shakyamuni Buddha, or if you're not religious, a ball of light, of the essence of all the goodness in the world, as if all the goodness, kindness, strength and power, wisdom and compassion in the world was gathered up into one. This ball of light, a pure source in front of you. So open your heart and ask for guidance, for protection, for help, energy, inspiration. And from your pure source, from Shakyamuni Buddha, white light comes streaming across space, flowing into you like a cascading waterfall of light, washing away all of those negativities associated with the body, all the illnesses, all the negative karmas, all the disturbing attitudes towards your body. Your body becomes clean and clear, radiant like crystal. Tayata om mone mone maha monaya soha. Tayata om mone mone maha monaya soha. Tayata om mone mone maha monaya soha. Feel how good it is to be washed clean, to be free of those negativities. And then asking the Buddha for inspiration and help. Think of two things. One, a positive activity that you can do to counterbalance a negative one, something you can physically do in the coming week to make up for it. It might be, if you've physically harmed someone else, that you can physically help somebody else, get them some shopping, donate blood, weed their garden. Or it might be that you cannot physically do anything for them, but you can dedicate something for them. You can read some Dharma books, do a meditation, donate on their behalf, do some prostrations, cook a memorial dinner. So a counterbalancing activity that's enjoyable, that you look forward to doing, that will redress that balance so that your sense of guilt and regret can diminish. The second thing, the amount of time you're going to refrain from that negative behavior. So especially if it's an addiction or a compulsion, something that you know you can commit to, it might only be half an hour. That's okay. If it's half an hour, make it 35 minutes. If it's a day, maybe a week, if it's something you'll know you'll never do again, say, for instance, have an abortion, then go from year to year. If it's about an abortion, then you can think what you do instead. If you accidentally got pregnant, what are all the other options? So the counterbalancing positive activity and the amount of restraint. Have them clear in your mind and think you're making a promise to the Buddha for the benefit of all. And from the Buddha's heart, blissful golden light, the essence of enlightened energy, wisdom, and compassion flows into you through the crown of your head, filling you up, every atom of your body becoming radiant and energized in that golden light energy. Tayata Om Mane Mane Maha Munaya Soha. Tayata Om Mane Mane Maha Munaya Soha. Tayata Om Mane Mane Maha Munaya Soha. Feel that you have received all of the skills and resources and strength to be able to fulfill your promise and to carry out your activities and restrain from the negativity. And the Buddha, or the source of light there in front of you, begins to grow smaller and brighter. Gradually comes across space to the crown of your head, hovers there for a moment, and then melts into you. And your body, speech, and mind become one with enlightened body, speech, and mind. Feel how different you feel. Look forward to the coming week of being able to act as this newly purified living being of body, speech, and mind, informed by this Buddha potential. And dedicate all of the efforts and your good-heartedness of today and this course to being able to be the very best embodied being that you can, and to be able to make full use of your potential all the way up to becoming a Buddha for the benefit of all. So thank you all very much, everybody. Let's just have a look. I have a little thing to read you just to finish up. It's a quote from Paul McKenna, this great book, I Can Make You Happy. And it's just a little summary. Being happy is simple. Being unhappy is complicated. Happiness teaches us that deep down we are already connected to each other and it reminds us to enjoy that. Happiness reminds us that every day is precious. Not one day of our lives will be repeated. Each day we can choose happiness. We can choose to live by our values, and we can choose to be grateful for the amazing possibilities. Over 50 scientific tests have shown that when large groups of people are peaceful and happy, there is a measurable reduction in violent crime. So every day you are happy increases the sum total of happiness in the world. And when enough of us live happily by our values, we actually make a real contribution to everyone's happiness. So don't keep your happiness to yourself. Spread it around and it'll make you happier still. There's an old Chinese proverb that I'd like to share with you. If you want happiness for an hour, take a nap. If you want happiness for a day, go dancing. If you want happiness for a year, inherit a fortune. It's about as long as it lasts. If you want happiness for a lifetime, help someone else. So it's great, isn't it? I hope you benefited from this course, and I hope to see you again. And I'll send out a feedback sheet on SurveyMonkey in the next day or two. I'd love to have your feedback, and really hope that you're able to embody all of this to have a fantastically happy life all the way up to authentic, lasting happiness of Buddhahood and enlightenment. See you soon, folks. Thank you.